the really magical shows, I think, are when we get the audience to really care about the story that we're making up, so that they care, they're invested in that as well as the story of watching improv happen. So when we have a good combination of those things, that we're playing really well together, but also we're creating characters and moments that make the audience go, oh, that's like the best.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. After years of thinking about it, it's finally here. Episode 1 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I am your very grateful host, Austin Meyer, and I'm pleased to bring you the first of what I hope to be many conversations with some of the world's best storytellers. I myself am a storyteller. More specifically, I am a documentary filmmaker and photographer, and I love talking about stories. I love thinking about their structure, what makes them work or not, their impact. I love talking about characters, conflict, emotions, imagery, dialogue. I think you get the point. On this podcast, I will interview incredible storytellers in a range of fields. I'm talking about filmmakers, photographers, journalists, novelists, artists, musicians, actors, actresses, and any other profession we can think of where people tell stories to make a positive difference in the world. These interviews will be deep dives into what makes a powerful story and what path led someone to become the influential storyteller they are today. I'm so excited to be in this journey of learning and discovery along with you. So without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce my first guest, Lisa Roland. Lisa Roland is a professional theatrical improviser. She is a member of Bats Improv, which is Northern California's most acclaimed and longest-running improvisational theater company, and she's also a founding member of Improv Playhouse and Awkward Dinner Party. Off the stage, Lisa is a lecturer at Stanford University in the theater department. She teaches the beginning improv class that actually put her on the path to improvisation. In 2012, Lisa was voted Best Actor by the SF Bay Guardians Reader Poll, but her bio feature that means the most to me was that she was my improv coach while I was performing with the Stanford Improvisers a number of years ago. Okay, so let's dim the house lights, let's pull the curtains back, and let's step out on stage for episode 1, my conversation with Lisa Roland. Let's get started.
Let's do it.
With the first episode, Name to Be Determined.
Great. Very exciting.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me into your home.
Yeah.
We are next to Dolores Park in San Francisco, California.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely area.
Beautiful.
Do you like living here?
I love it.
What do you like about it?
You know, my favorite thing about it is my neighbors. I really like the people in my building, but I love having Dolores Park nearby, partly because I can feel like I'm a part of all of the crazy, like on especially crazy days, without actually having to be out there. There's always bathrooms nearby because I live a block from the park, which is really nice. And the weather is good in this neighborhood and parking is pretty easy and I live alone.
Are you from the East Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you ever go back to the East Bay much?
All the time.
All the time.
Because my nieces are there.
Family.
My parents are there. My sister and her wife are there. My kid, my nieces are there. So
I love that.
Yeah.
So I want to start by hearing a little bit about how you became a professional improviser.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if it still sounds amazing to you that you're a professional improviser, but that's just such a cool title.
It's so cool.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how you got into this.
Yeah,
take us way back.
Great. So I want to say that I got into professional improv by surprise, in a way. Like, it was never a design, but I started improvising in high school and then had several transition points at which I figured I would probably never improvise again. So in high school, my friends started up an improv league at a neighboring high school. Our school started a team. My friends were part of starting that. So they were like, Lisa, you should do this. I was like, yeah, great. So I did, but then graduated and didn't think that improv was something that would carry over. I was just like, well, that was fun. And then we'll go on to whatever happens next. I got to Stanford, met people who were involved in the improv world, and they were like, Lisa, you should do this. And I was like, great, yeah, okay, cool, I will. So I took the class, did the thing. It became the defining experience of my Stanford time. Graduated, thought that I was going to move away, go to grad school, get an MFA, or move away to go be an actor. I was going to move to Chicago and be an actor.
To be a scripted
actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. be in plays and musicals, and I, so I was like, yeah, improv if it comes up, but improv's not the thing that I'm gonna do. And then I wound up, even though improv had, I want to say in college, it sort of took root in me, and I became, the way I describe it, a capital I improviser, sort of like, this is who I am. This is what I do. It describes my mindset, the approach that I want to take. I believe in improv in a way that sort of surprised me as well. And just in terms of an approach to sort of everything. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't get into grad school in my anywhere. And my mom convinced me not to move away, which sounds awful, but actually her reasoning was great, which was, she was like, you're going into a field that is just riddled with rejection. Like, that's one thing you know, is that you're going to get rejected. And you don't know a soul in Chicago. Like, why would you go to a place where you are totally alone and isolated and take a beating in the profession that you've chosen? Why don't you just get your legs under you and audition and be in plays here in San Francisco? And then once you sort of get an idea of what this feels like, what the profession feels like, then move. Right, like build a little resume where you have a support network.
Right.
And I was like, that actually makes a lot of sense. So I decided to stay. And because I did, I was looking for part-time jobs to fill my, to support my auditioning habit. Mm-hmm. And I got forwarded a job posting at Bats Improv, which is the San Francisco improv group that I play with now. Stanford has a close relationship with them. So I knew of Bats. I had been to Bats. Bats coaches had come down to teach us. And I applied for there was a job to help run the school of improv there, part-time, flexible hours. I applied for it, poured my heart into this cover letter explaining how I believe in Johnstonian style collaboration, how powerful it is when improvisers decide to work together and the magic that's made, blah, blah, blah. And got the job, started working in the office. Shortly after that, the artistic director was like, aren't you an improviser? And I was like, well, yeah. And he was like, well, you should audition for the company. So I did and got in as a guest and then got in permanently and then started getting teaching offers. And then people were like, why don't you do some of this corporate stuff? And hey, there's a festival in Germany you should come to. And it just sort of, I remember the experience of sort of looking around my life and going, I think I'm an improviser. Like, I think that's what I do, yeah. Which, like, was such a surprise.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the central thing that I do. That's the main thing that I do.
Right. So I want to go back to your time at Stanford when you said that the improv suddenly started to take root. So Maybe you can describe a little bit for people who have never seen improv theater, what we're talking about when we're talking about improv.
Yeah.
And, like, what was that you were doing at Stanford? And compare and contrast that to the scripted theater, which maybe you had more of a background in and you were also doing at Stanford and you thought that would be what you'd do in the future. So maybe what are the differences between those?
Right.
And what started to take root as an improviser?
Yeah. So the biggest difference between those, they are both forms of theater. Scripted theater has a script, improv does not. So in improvisation, it's very much a team sport, and I actually sort of call it collaborative storytelling, sort of spontaneous collaborative storytelling. So improvisation is the act of making theater without a script. Some people really gear that theater toward comedy. So our icons like Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and the folks in Saturday Night Live use improvisation to come up with sketches really aimed at comedy, but they sort of come up with it just by playing together, pretending together. And it also can take this more theatrical bent, which Stanford does, which is really storytelling, looking to tell the next, to sort of tell a story that could either be 3 minutes long, like a little story, or it could be an entire 90-minute story in a style or just sort of an open story, just where nobody knows what happens ahead of time. So we all just pay attention and do it and tell the next part of the story as we think it might go. Mm-hmm. Does that get to it?
Yeah.
Kind of.
And so what started to, like, fuel
to,
the fire?
To, like, see, to take
fire.
Root,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing that made me feel like I was sort of fundamentally an improviser was the fact that, especially the way that I learned improv at Stanford from Patricia Ryan Madsen, is she really teaches improv as a value system. It's an art form, and also the way that we show up to the stage as improvisers is also the way that I would like to show up to my life, to my relationships, to my choices, to situations that I'm faced with. And that way, sort of the improviser's way, the improviser's mindset, is to show up with attention, right? We pay attention. We accept what's in front of us. We take care of each other. We play well together. We believe that we're stronger together than we are individually. So our collaboration skills are honed. We work on that. Spontaneously and playfully. So we're sort of playful, we're bold, we're generous, we're attentive, we're accepting. And I was like, this stuff is just how I want to, that's how I want to be, right? Yeah. So it's sort of, I got sort of addicted to that. And improv gave me this way of, in the same way that people meditate to practice being a certain way, I improvise to practice being a certain way, and it keeps me connected to how I want to be in the world. So that feels really good. And that's sort of what, on a deep, almost spiritual level, what took root.
Yeah.
But the other, like, speaking of differences between scripted theater and improv, one thing that I noticed is that, because I was still doing scripted theater,
right. And
after a scripted show, you know, it's like you do a play, you've rehearsed it and rehearsed it and rehearsed it, and I love the rehearsal process and I love lines. So it's I love scripted theater also. You do a play, you come back, and your roommate's like, so how'd the show go? And there's like a range of answers, you know? You could be like, oh, well, it's really, our pace was really great tonight, or, oh, the second act dragged, or, no, oh, the house wasn't too warm, so it was rough, or whatever. But like the range of those answers is pretty narrow, because you know what the play is, and the play happens the way the play is every night. And you come back from an improv show, and it's like, how was it? And the range of answers is so wide, right? Because it could either be miserable and I don't know what I'm doing. It was a complete train wreck. Just complete. It was awkward for us. It was awful for the audience. Like, everybody should get their money back. This was horrible. Or like transcendent, just magically transporting and feeling like you're on drugs, right? I mean, it's just like, it feels, you feel high after a really great show because it feels like magic. It feels like magic, especially theatrical. So stories, when we're telling extended stories together, because it's like, how did that happen? Like, I didn't make that happen.
Right.
I was part of it, but I could not have told you that that is what was going to happen. And when it all comes together well, mm-hmm. It just feels like, oh my God. Like, it just feels so exciting.
Okay, so take us behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And it feels like that as an audience member. You see improv for the first time, you're like, how did that story come together?
How did they do that? Yeah.
So let's dive a little bit into story.
Yeah.
How do stories come together?
Yeah.
In improv.
Okay. I feel like there's a connection, or rather, there's a combination of really boring skills that you need to be good at.
Okay.
Like remembering names.
Mm-hmm. Someone steps on stage.
And names a character, right? Yeah. So I come on and I'm like, hey, Brian, so glad you're back at work after your injury. I need to remember that you're Brian, and everybody else needs to remember that you're Brian, and you need to remember that you're Brian,
right?
And that you were injured, and that you're back to work. Mm-hmm. Like, all of those things are really important if we're going to build a story, because we have nothing when we start, so every little piece of information is potentially key to the story. And maybe it's not, right? Because we don't know until the end of the story, looking back, what ends up being important, but all of them might be important. So there's like memory and listening and attention and like remembering names and remembering, you know, locations and relationships and like the boring details so that we can build stories upon them. And then there is sort of a collective agreement to tell a story and make what's on stage matter for the next scene, right? So we all sort of have an understanding of what a story feels like and what ingredients go into making a story, and understanding that stories can take a number of different forms. So some of them can be flashbacks, right? So maybe the first scene starts and then somebody in that scene starts to tell a story and we'd flash back to that, and that's the story that we're telling, and then we jump back to the present and we wrap it all up at, you know, at the end. Mm-hmm. So we don't know necessarily what the specific structure of the story is going to be. And so we need to stay really, really connected to one another to navigate that uncertainty together and still make the whole thing feel cohesive. Make it feel like it's not seven different people with their own ideas about where this story is going to go, duking it out, mm-hmm. right? Hoping to get everybody else on their page.
Right.
And sometimes that happens. Like, they don't all go well. And
right.
Ideally, And in the best of circumstances, everybody is sort of egoless and they're serving this other thing that's being built in the middle of all of their energies, you know, sort of as a combination of all of their mental, emotional, heart-based, physical energies.
So how do you prepare, you know, so we're talking about primarily long-form improv, not quite like Whose Line Is It Anyway when you get out, play like a small little game, throw out a joke, and then kind of move on. We're talking about long-form improv.
And specifically sort of single-narrative long-form improv.
Single-narrative, okay.
Like a movie or a play.
Right, a movie or play.
Yeah.
So how do you prepare, say if your format, you know, maybe you can talk about some of the range of formats you do from like a Shakespeare to how do you prepare or study story so that when you get out there and you're relying on everyone's kind of feel of like, we need to move to a next scene, we need to introduce a new character, we need to introduce a conflict. It seems like there has to be some sort of baseline understanding amongst the group of those beats. Is that true?
Yes and yes.
It's okay if it's no.
And no.
Okay, great.
Which is, there are some people who tell stories relatively formulaically.
Okay.
And that makes it much more straightforward. Where it's like, the first scene, this happens. Scene number two, we meet the protagonist. Scene number three, there is an inciting event and an obstacle. Scene number four, we introduce subplot A, right? It was like, so there's sort of beats or markers that everybody in the cast agrees to, and I don't play that way. So in that way, there's not set things that need to happen in a story. So it's not like, oh no, it's scene three, we're supposed to be doing this now. There's sort of no supposed to about it. Mm-hmm. We all just sort of agree to follow the story and go where it goes. However, we do all... So part of it is that we've played together for a really long time and we're all sort of consumers of popular culture and stories, and we do that attentively so that we can sort of pay attention to what kinds of storytelling there is. But especially when we do formats or genres, so Shakespeare, film noir, Western, play, the American play, the American stage play, so like just three-act stage play on a single location, what kind of story is told in that context versus... an adventure movie or like a spy thriller, which we've also done, an improvised Bond sort of genre.
Yeah.
And in that case, the preparation is watching the stuff. So like watch a bunch of Bond films or read a bunch of film noir, watch a bunch of film noir, brush up on Westerns. And so sort of soaking in not only the world that's set in, read a bunch of Shakespeare out loud so that you get the language, but you also get the sorts of things that happen in those stories. So we look for things like, you know, the things that happen in a Western are really different than the things that happen in a noir. Mm-hmm. And Westerns are often about sort of revenge, and there's this sort of outlaw code of ethics that you want to look at, and the outlaws play by those rules. And there's often, you know, the kinds of people who show up in the Old West. In noir, we know that there's generally this femme fatale who sort of uses vulnerability to ask for help, and then there's someone who haplessly winds up on the wrong side of a really bad plot, you know, and is punished for it, right? Like, winds up in a really bad situation because they got sort of taken along. So we know that these sorts of things happen, and we look at, in preparation for telling those sorts of stories, we look at a couple of things. What kinds of characters show up in those stories? Even though we're not going to play specific characters, but like what kinds of people might there be? What technology was there? Mm. So time period, how did people get around? What was money? What did people wear? Mm. What did they know? What else was going on in the world?
Right.
So when we do the Old West, it's like, okay, so where is the Old West? If it's in Wyoming, how do they refer to the East Coast? Mm. And they would talk about it as back in the States. Right?
Super
so like people
detailed.
So looking at what else is going on in the world so we understand sort of contextualizing the time period that we're playing in. Mm-hmm. We don't make anachronistic calls to the best of our ability. Mm-hmm. And then of course it's improv and we can't know everything, and so we fake a bunch of stuff, you know? Like, I don't know exactly what kind of terrain there is in Idaho, so we'll make up that there are high deserts and mountains. You know, like we'll just make that up.
Yeah.
And maybe we're right and maybe we're not. And that's the part where it's like and we practice supporting each other. So whatever that call is, nobody's going to be corrected. We just go with it.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah.
If you were to go finish a show and a friend comes to you and says that question that you mentioned earlier, how was that show?
How'd it go?
If a show went great,
yeah,
what happened on that stage that makes you feel that way after hundreds of shows that you've done? If you're going to come back now and say that show was a great show, what ingredients are that?
A ton of fun. Mm-hmm. So like I was surprised and delighted by my partners. That's a key ingredient. Mm-hmm. We somehow had a moment that felt, had moments that felt true. Mm-hmm. Like true things happened to the characters. Things that we like, oh, you know, oh, we made the audience care. That's it. We made the audience care about the characters. So this is kind of interesting. This is an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah.
In any improv show, there's sort of two stories going on at the same time.
Okay.
That the audience is watching. They are watching the story that we are making up. You know, I'm playing a character named Helen, and she's going to go to grad school and be a scientist, and there's all these things. And then there's also the story of a group of six players coming to a theater to make up a story, right? So it's, they're watching the improvisers work together, and they're watching the story that is resulting. And they get delight from both of those things. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And sometimes the really magical shows, I think, are when we get the audience to really care about the story that we're making up, so that they care, they're invested in that as well as the story of watching improv happen. Because it's delightful to watch improv happen.
Right.
And there's times when we can tell stories where we're really just like having fun with each other and the audience is liking it and they're watching us make stuff up, but it's not really about the story. The story's good, it's there, but the more fun thing is watching improvisers sort of adjust and play with each other and screw with each other and, you know,
yeah,
and get through, like, handle unexpected stuff. And it's the improv that's fun to watch. And then sometimes it's the story that's really exciting to watch. Right? So when we have a good combination of those things, that we're playing really well together, but also we're creating characters and moments that make the audience go, oh, that's like the best.
Yeah. You never want them, so it sounds like you never want them to become so immersed in the story that they lose the joy of seeing people like improvising.
I kind of can't imagine that happening. I get, right?
Like, there's so many screw ups.
Or just so many moments of unexpected discovery that
right.
Everybody notices.
Fair,
you know,
yeah. Right.
So we notice, and I think that's why they come to see improv instead of going to a play.
And so
it's cheaper. It's generally cheaper than going to ACP or something.
Going back, you identified three things that make a good show. Something that feels true.
Mm-hmm.
There were surprises, or you were surprised, maybe the
and
audience
delighted.
Surprised and
yeah.
delighted, and then making the audience care. So on making the audience care, you identified the characters really do that.
Yeah, I'm like trying to, the characters and how they respond to the moments that they're in, I'm just trying to remember instances where we got verbal, or not verbal, but vocal responses from an audience.
A gasp.
Yeah. Not laughter,
right.
But cheering, yelling, gasping, like, oh, you know, sadness. Mm-hmm. And it's like they really invested in a character and something happened to that character cared about. Mm-hmm. You know, that disappointed them or that whatever. Yeah.
And why do you think... What do you think goes into making an audience care about the character? Like, why do they sometimes care about a character and sometimes they're like, yeah, like, oh, he lost the girl. That's
I think the actor needs to play it real. They need to be good actors. Mm. And sometimes improvisers don't do that. Sometimes improvisers sort of mug and like, look at me, I'm playing the leading man. But they're not playing it like a real human being. So we need to see your humanity and your vulnerability. I think vulnerability makes an audience care. And specificity makes an audience care. So you're playing a real person and not a type. Mm-hmm. I think the less specific it is, the less exciting it, the less juicy it is.
Yeah.
Right? Or engaging, the less right. engaging. And that character has to care. That character has to care about something.
You have to see that that character really is motivated by something or really wants something so that you're pulling for him or, him or her or...
Yeah. It's hard to care about indifferent characters. Mm-hmm. So they've got to be affected by the world around them. They've got to love it. They've got to want to change it, right? They've got to... There's something about it that they're really... That really gets them, you know? And, yeah. And that can look a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you might just see a glimmer of that, of, like, somebody who just kind of... Maybe someday. Oh, no, never mind. You know, like, there's some little something that gives them the idea that, oh, yeah, that they want something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... When you step out on stage, you have no idea who you're going to be.
Mm-mm.
Or anything about your character.
Yeah, it's so great.
So how do you create that character who really wants something? Or that character who's really, like you were saying, has specificity, nuance? How do you create that when you have no idea what you're going to be?
Yeah. It's sort of like a... I think it's sort of a... Yeah, that's like a great question. How does that happen? How do we do that? I think it can start a lot of different ways. So you can start sort of with a specificity around a physicality. So like I'm going to come on with a particular posture or stance, and that's all I've got to start with. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple of things that right? So the process can be, you know, you take a stance or a posture, and then start walking around and notice what that gives you.
Right.
Right. So it's like you enter the stage with this way, and suddenly I realize, oh, I'm very sort of fastidious and detail-oriented. That's like my deal. That's why I walk this way. But it's sort of a discovering that. Mm-hmm. And then if nothing is discovered, then you just got to make something up. Right. You got to just do it. Mm-hmm. You make it happen. But so it could start physically or vocally, you know, kind of grab something that gives you something that is different mm-hmm. than yourself.
Yeah. Or could that be like you come on stage and you're crying?
Yeah.
Or you're
emotionally. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. And then you find out if this is a character who's always crying or if something just happened to this character and they don't never cry. That's a different thing for this character, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I feel like the other ways that I is like practicing allowing yourself to care. So one of the things that beginners often do is sort of, no, that's not really fair. I don't know if it's a beginner's thing.
Well, I mean,
but
you've obviously noticed it.
I've noticed it,
yeah.
Is that like, allow yourself to be changed. And so when somebody mentions, when somebody sort of throws an offer out, allowing yourself to be changed by that offer, to really notice it and pick it up and let it affect you. So that could be I think that's a way to find vulnerability in a character, right? So I'm just imagining, for instance, two people, coworkers, they're talking about what they did over the weekend. One says, oh yeah, I went and I saw the, you know, local soccer team or whatever. Oh yeah, didn't you play soccer once upon a time? And the other person can say, yeah, I did, but, you know, it's in the past. Or they can be like, yeah, still think about that. You know, and there's a moment to allow that to sort of matter to your character. And, like, let it be. And then suddenly we have a, oh, maybe they want something, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we have this little seed of, oh, they have a dream that's unfulfilled somehow, you know?
I like how you use that example in the presence of someone who aspired to be a professional soccer player and didn't make it.
Shit.
Thank you.
I really didn't. It was unintentional.
So why don't you think that's our natural inclination is to let, you know,
to be affected
by things like that?
Because I think it's safer to be totally okay. It's like safer to be unflappable. Even to play characters who are unflappable, it sort of feels vulnerable to allow yourself to be swayed or it's like a, you sort of have higher status or like the upper hand if nothing phases you. Right? So it's like, yeah, fine. I don't care.
I don't care about soccer.
I don't care.
That didn't impact me.
It didn't impact me.
When
whatever.
You just said that, Lisa.
No, I know. It's really... Woohoo!
Yeah.
And so it can feel a little bit... I think it can feel a little bit... Okay. Maybe it's like this.
Okay.
Improv is a little bit like a little lab of a lab of distilled human interaction.
I like where we're going.
Okay. So we get to try stuff on, and it's real human things that we're aping, right? I mean, it's we're pretending to be real people. And so the interactions that we're having are interactions that feel very much like interactions we have out in the world. They're just in an imagined set of circumstances, right? So we have this shared commitment to an imagined reality. But that means that, like, in the same way that it feels bad out in the world to lose face or to show vulnerability, it sort of triggers the same stuff in your brain on an improv stage to, like, allow yourself to show vulnerability. So there's some part of you that's like, no, don't do that. Keep yourself safe. Like, don't show them that you're sad, even though it's pretend, right? But I think that there's some part of your brain that, like, doesn't know the difference, you know? And so that's the part of it that's so... I had a great improv teacher, a woman that I've... Her name is Jill Bernard. She's out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and she made this little video about improv, and one of the pieces of advice she gave was, don't sleep with anyone in your improv team. You think you're falling in love, but really what's happening is you just spend a lot of time practicing being vulnerable together, and it's not the same thing. And I was like, oh yeah, right? We practice being vulnerable together, and that's like a pretty intimate thing, and that's what improvisers practice, is being willing to be changed, being willing to be made sad instead of angry, right? So when we're changed, we sort of allow ourselves to feel things. But that can be a lot of people go through their whole lives trying to escape what they feel, you know? Yeah. And so I think that's a long, potentially excessively deep answer to a question of...
For why, so how
why
do you make an audience
changed.
Care? And how do you make the audience care
yeah.
about a character? Sounds like what you're saying is that vulnerability is a key part.
Key.
Yeah.
Key.
So then the other...
They don't care about invulnerable characters.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the other ingredient to what you said was a great show, and I'm kind of like a little surprised to hear it, is that you said surprise.
Yeah.
Because there's one thing that's like, if this is improv, like one of the defining characteristics of this art form is that every second is a surprise because nothing's planned.
Right.
Right? So wouldn't every show be surprising?
Here, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Not every show is surprising. Sometimes it feels a little bit like, what's the best way to describe this? Because you're right. It's like, we don't know what the story's going to be. Sometimes there are shows that are sort of heavily formatted and we kind of get into a groove where we're like, oh, we know this story. Okay. It's like romantic comedies.
Yeah.
The plots are not surprising.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
When you go to see a movie, you know what's going to happen. You get how that goes. Ideally, there's something along the way that is delightful, you know? And so sometimes it can sort of feel like, yeah, we're all sort of going through the motions to do the thing that comes next, but we're not sort of on the edge of oh my God, what is going to happen? What's going to happen now? And so when the stories, one of the most impactful stories I remember being in was a Shakespeare show,
okay.
And it was just the world that we created was so big, it was so rich, and the feeling that I had was every moment felt like we were maybe running off the rails, but we never did, you know? So it was like, every moment was like, is this working? Are we all on? I think we are. I think we're still on the same page. I think this all still holds together. I don't know how exactly. I don't have a handle on it all. But so there's when stories sort of feel too predictable in a way, even though, yeah, this particular story hasn't been told this way, but we sort of get what happens and we go through it.
Yeah.
We're not really like sparking off of each other. Mm-hmm. That's the difference, maybe.
So the surprise, you know, if something or someone on stage throws out something completely wild and you get the audience reaction of a huge laugh, like, oh, no one's that surprised us. That's not necessarily what you're talking about, surprise. You're almost thinking like more macro. You're like...
Macro.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of like, whoa, cool. Right? So it's either like I didn't see the story going in that direction, or it could be sort of the delight, like it could be really great shows, right? Surprise and delight. It could be that like I think maybe the I could try to finish one of those sentences. I think that, okay, maybe like one of the ingredients is that you feel like your fellow players are like right there with you. You're like in this moment, figuring out only the next step together as you go. And when it starts to feel like you're playing with folks and their head is like, yeah, I get this, I'm doing this story, but they're no longer like right in this moment with you, then it's less exciting and it's less vital and it's inevitably less surprising because we're all just sort of doing the thing that we figure happens now. But the delight part can be, even if we are telling a story that is more or less laid out plot-wise, like we used to do this murder mystery format that is pretty formulaic. Starts with a murder where we never see the murderer, ends with that same scene where we do see the murderer. That's a series of interrogations in like an old British manor with all manner of eccentric characters, right? We know it's going to happen. But those could still feel like really fun shows if you feel like you're really playing with the people that you're on stage with. It's like you're right in the same zone and like having a lot of fun together, you know? And sometimes, believe it or not, it's like not... Sometimes it feels more like work. Like, yeah, okay, it's time to go on there and do something. So I will, and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
But it's not like, oh, yay! You know, ideally, those are the good shows. Yeah. And you can even do a fine show like that, right? So it's like sometimes I come home and I'm like, that was a good show. That was by all definite, right? Like by all sort of measurements or whatever. And that was like a solid, that was a fine show. And the audience would be like, that was great. And I'm like, yeah, I'm so happy that you enjoyed it. You know what I mean? And it just didn't hit that like magical, soaring, transcendent, like awesome thing for me from the inside.
Right.
But that's nice that it goes that way and not the other way, mm-hmm. where I have a great show time and the audience doesn't.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm also curious to learn about your life teaching improv, because I think you have a unique perspective of this craft because you do teach beginners.
Yeah.
You're now teaching back where you studied at Stanford.
Yeah, I'm teaching the class I took.
Teaching the class you took.
That both of us took.
Right, yes. And you teach in corporate environments. And when we're thinking about improv or story, you touched on one of the kind of common mistakes that you see beginners make, or like you try to encourage people to take care when they're on stage. So what are some of the other things that you notice beginning storytellers when it comes to improv resisting?
Most of it is being negative and trying to make stuff too interesting too soon. Mm. So like, say something wacky right out of the gate. And it's like, oh no, we're not ready for that yet. Mm-hmm. we don't know what this world is yet, so we can't have a wacky thing. We gotta figure out what the world is before the wacky thing comes in.
So let's break that down.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say like we don't know what the world is yet?
Yeah, and great, why can't it's a great question.
Why can't wacky happen right away?
Yeah. Well, I mean, anything can happen. It's improv. There's no rules and everything could always work. Okay. But generally speaking, that feels like a disclaimer I need to give. It's like my belief in improv is like, yeah, it's going to work sometime, somewhere. But generally, I find that the audience cares way more about a scene. And this could be a short scene, right? About the characters in the scene. If they just have a chance to sort of get to know them, who they are, what they do, how they know each other, what the world is that they're living in. By which I mean, what's the time period? Where are they? Like, what location are they in? What are they doing there? How do they feel about it? Like, what's the stuff, you know? Before a bomb is dropped. So if the first line is, oh my God, the aliens are here. It's like, well, where and why do we care? And who's, like, what's the, what is, like, I don't even, what's the issue, you know? But if we see like this lovely little, you know, family scene on a pastoral in a farmhouse, and we get to know that like little Lillian just birthed her first calf and she's really excited about it, and you know, dad is, the harvest is early this year, or what, you know, whatever, so we get some details of the world, so we feel like, ah, that's the world we're playing in,
right?
Then when the aliens come, we have some idea of what the impact is, meaning we care about what that is because we know who it's impacting. So in improv parlance, there is, in storytelling, improv storytelling parlance, it's the platform and the tilt. So you build the platform first, which is who, what, where, how do we, what do we know about these people, what's the world we're looking at, and then the tilt is new information. Something changes. This day is not like other days. Mm-hmm. And that could be positive, or it could be negative, or it could be just somebody having a big reaction to, you know, to something, or making a confession. New information comes out, and because of that information, things change. So oftentimes, new improvisers, I think, for fear of being boring and feeling like they've got to make something happen in order to make this thing interesting, they rush to a lot of plot right away, where there's just like, there's so much more time that we're willing to just watch things happen before anything big needs to happen in a scene.
Right.
So that's one thing, is like patience is not easily come by.
Yeah.
And the second thing is being negative. So, and I think that those two things are tied. Being negative, like having a problem, starting a scene in a fight, or having a problem with the person they're in a scene with. Are you wearing my sweater? I told you not to. You can't smoke out here. No, that's not how you do it. You're late again. One more time and you're fired, right? Like any number of, or even more subtle, like shopping again. Okay. Right? Where it's like, oh, you're not happy. And it's like, why not? Like, we don't like to hang out with complainers. Why do we want to watch them on stage? You right. know? So I think part of that is the fear of the real sort of human fear of the unknown. And in improv, that shows up where it's like, I don't know where this story is going, but I understand fighting. So it's like, if I give myself a conflict, then bam, I get the scope of this scene. We're going to deal with this conflict. That is like something for us to both hang on to. Mm-hmm. But if everything's sort of fine in this world, I feel like I'm just paddling or flailing. I don't know what to hang on to. I don't know what this scene is about.
So when is it appropriate for conflict to happen? Because conflict can be really fascinating.
Totally, yeah. I think conflict is best when you discover it. So like, give it a chance to show up in the scene. And it's kind of fun to invite improvisers to like, see how long you can hold it off. See how long you can keep it out of the scene. And then trouble always finds its own way in. It finds its way in. You'll get in trouble. Like, it will happen. So let's work on the good stuff and trust that the trouble will come. It does not need your help. It's sort of how we talk about
it. And maybe in the alien example, if you start immediately with the aliens, that might not be a conflict. The audience doesn't really necessarily know.
Yeah.
Because this might be a world where the aliens come all the
time. Totally, right?
And
if the first line is, the aliens are here, the second line could be like, oh, they're late today. Okay, great, right? Or they're early. Or, hey, that's awesome. They've returned with our slaves.
But if you have that platform, that who, what, where, then when there's the tilt, when something happens or conflict occurs, then that can actually have some impact.
Impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the unique things about improv is how collaborative the storytelling is. So for me, as a photographer, as a videographer, I'm often doing things alone. I'm out on the streets taking photos of people alone, or even though filmmaking can be very collaborative, just as I'm starting my career as a video journalist, it's just happened that I've been alone a lot. So what value do you think collaborative storytelling has in improv and then beyond it to people who tell stories in other ways?
So the collaborative nature of the art form is one of the things that I love the most about it. For me, mostly because it means that I get to be delighted by the contents of the imaginations of other really smart, playful adults. And adults don't often play, right? So out in the world. And so it's exciting. That's an exciting thing to engage in. But it's kind of interesting, actually, because your storytelling sort of, well, I think there are parts of your job that are very much the same as mine in terms of you make offers. So when I'm on stage playing with people, it's like I make an offer and then somebody else makes an offer and that indicates or that sort of decides the direction of the story for a while and then I'll make an offer and we sort of just build it together bit by bit. And I feel like you do the same thing. It's just that the offers are coming from the world around you, right? And you were just telling me about this piece that you made where it was like, oh, like you sort of pay attention and notice what's there and then see what you can play with. And then you're in a conversation and you get new information and it's like, oh, well, great. Well, in that case, I'll do this. Mm-hmm. So sort of improvisers have one another to build a story with, you know, and we practice that sort of giving and receiving offers. And everybody's doing that all the time with their lives. like life will throw you an offer. And sometimes it seems shitty, right? Like you don't get the job you want or you get dumped or you know, whatever it is. And that's an offer. And you can block that offer and pretend that it didn't happen or fight it or convince it to be different. Or you can be like, okay, here's the new reality. What does this mean for the next step of my story, right? And you move in the direction that seems to make the most sense. In improv, the thing that is the most interesting or compelling or something about that collaboration piece is that we've all got ideas for where these stories might go and we all just have to practice letting that shit go because there's all these other brains on stage. And as soon as one of them says, well, maybe this, then it's like your job is to shed your idea and be like, yes, that's where we are now. Okay. So from this piece, I got an idea for like the next step. And everyone else is like, yes, great. That next step. And then person three is like, maybe this next. And we all jump on that. And thereby we create this story that none of us could have anticipated on our own. And I find that to be very magical. So much artistic creation, photography, documentary filmmaking, like you're doing, painting, writing, songwriting, music, like so much of that, sculpting, sewing, it was like so many things. They're solitary activities. And I think a lot of art can feel solitary. And I think this is why I wound up in improv, is like you just gotta get all up in other people. Like they're all up in you and you just like work it out together and it's a little chaotic and that's so lovely.
Yeah.
For my personality type. I really like it.
Yeah.
And it's just constantly surprising that way.
And it's something that I think I want to seek out more of, mm-hmm. is working alongside other people. I think when we're doing creative work, going back to that theme of vulnerability, sometimes it can be hard to put your creative work in front of someone and have them take some control.
Totally.
So it's a lesson that I want to like take into my own work, and I think probably a lot of other people need to too.
Yeah, and part of the thing that makes it possible is understanding and really believing that we are better if we are together, but we live in a society that assigns credit to one person often. And so it's like, but this is mine. And I want to make sure that I get recognized for it and that I'm responsible for it. And then there's also the like, I don't want you to ruin my idea. But if we can kind of like hold it lightly and be like, but maybe you got something great that I just would never have thought of.
Right.
And then I'll have something that you never thought of. And then we'll just go somewhere wild. Yeah.
Going to your shows that you're performing in these days. I got to see you in a show that you're currently putting on called Awkward Dinner Party. I would love for you to describe the premise of this format, which I believe you and your teammates created.
Yeah.
And why that
works.
Was like, yeah, why it works. Like, why did you choose this format as something that's like ripe for a good story?
Yeah. This is so cool. I love Awkward Dinner Party. So it's a three-person show. Mm-hmm. my partner Dave and I are awkward dinner party, and then we invite a guest to play with us every time we perform it. So there's a rotating guest. And the premise of the story, or of the format, is that Dave and I are a couple, we're throwing a dinner party, and only one person shows up to the dinner party for reasons that we discover during the course of the show. So none of that is decided ahead of time. That is a storyline that we follow through the entire evening. The whole night takes place on the night of the dinner party. So it's sort of more or less real time, kind of. It's all in the living room of our home. And it's like watching a play about people at a dinner party. So we sort of follow that over the course of the night. And generally, the thing that happens is that the imbalance that is created out of this unexpected thing happening, where only one person shows up to your dinner party, allows for something new to come out. So it either sort of highlights a relationship dynamic between the couple, between Dave and I. There is some dynamic that is made possible because this person is solo between them and either Dave and I that shows up. It uncovers some history. It catalyzes some change. So something happens because of the sort of imbalance of that three number, which is cool.
Oh, so the fact that there's three, like there's a pair and then there's a single.
Yeah.
There's something about numerically
that's good.
Yeah, that creates some interesting relationship.
Yeah, that I think would not happen if there was two couples. Right, if we invited a couple over for dinner and we saw what happened, something else would happen. But I think three is particularly ripe for good stuff coming out. But then the other half of this show is that from time to time we sort of break out into unassociated scenes and songs that have nothing to do with it. It's like you change the channel, dip into a totally different kind of show before you come back to the dinner party storyline.
And why do you do that?
Partly for variety, partly because Dave and I both really like doing both long form and short form, so we made a show that we could do both in. Yeah. But what we discovered about it after we did it was that the short form really allows us to, the sort of release of the release and the energetic difference of the short form allows us to sort of go deeper in the long form. Mm. Part of that is because...
For the audience or for you as players?
Both.
So the audience gets a chance to relax, laugh maybe at something goofy.
Totally, totally.
And you get to just play in a different way, different characters.
Play in a different way, play, yeah, accents, different physical characters, playing multiple characters, playing in totally different time frames and eras and genres, and there's music and singing, and we just get to sort of stretch our improv muscles, which feels good as players and is fun to watch for an audience. And then emotionally what it does, especially if it's in a sort of dramatic storyline in the dinner party, is it gives them a little release moment so it doesn't become too much. And then we get to go back into that dramatic storyline without feeling like we're just weighing everybody down. So it lets us engage further with the drama because we've given people a release.
So if we're taking that as a lesson for storytelling, there is something about the rhythm.
Yes.
It even reminds me of like Lord of the Rings and like the Two Towers, that movie. They suddenly had like these moments of comedy. Or even in Star Wars, they kind of have that.
Totally.
Like
Shakespeare's
fighting, full, fighting, fighting.
Shakespeare's
comedy
full
moment.
Of them. Yeah.
Like Shakespeare, that's a little bit more cultured example of that.
But also, this is actually something I noticed recently. I was watching Hasan Minhaj.
So good.
So good.
His comedy special on Netflix, incredible.
Incredible.
Yes.
So he does an amazing job of telling a story. Sometimes it's very sad.
Yeah.
Sometimes his story is like sad and deep, and then he pops you back up with a hilarious line that gets you laughing, and then you can go back and like engage with this heavy material. You know, and he does a lot of political comedy that is about real things that is hard to hear, and he just has this take on it that allows you to that makes it digestible. So, and he's a storyteller. I mean, he's a comedian,
a
but he's a storyteller. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. It's cool. And I actually, so I got to interview him.
Really?
I did. I like moderated a Q&A with him at
cool.
Stanford,
uh-huh.
Which was like so cool. And he talked about how he sort of conceptualized that special as theater. He's like, oh, when I looked at it as theater, Like, I'm creating theatrical moments. I'm creating moments for the audience rather than just like a guy with a mic. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, that allowed him to, I think, and that's actually, it allowed him to include a wider range of human experience in his show. And that's how I feel about improvised storytelling, is that there is part of the sort of family of improvisers who really use improv for comedy, and I just feel like that sells improv short in a way. Or rather, that thinking that it can only be for that, it's like great if that's just all you like about it, but thinking it can only be for that really sells it short in terms of all of the other human experiences that we can put on stage and that people care to watch. And that when coupled with the delight and surprise of spontaneous moments being made in front of your eyes, it's like it can be really impactful and sort of elevated and exciting.
Definitely.
Yeah.
For the listeners, that Netflix special we're referring to, I believe it's called Homecoming King.
Homecoming King.
By Hasan Minhaj. It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people to check that out.
Guy's got great hair.
Great hair.
Great hair. Really, 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 real nice guy.
So for people out there who are trying to become better storytellers in whatever form that takes, whether it's filmmaking and photography like me, if it's written form, if it's creating a marketing campaign at their, whatever it is, telling better dinner table stories.
Yeah.
What lessons can we take from improv?
Here's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Be specific. I don't know if that's like an improv, I don't know how improv-y that is, but it's the thing that I use the most, which is like, get specific. What is the smell? What do you smell? What do you see? Are you going to the gym after work, or are you going to the 24-hour fitness because they just got a new treadmill and you want to try it out? You know, like, what's the, get in there so that the audience or the listener can like see it.
Yeah.
So it transports them, because you're not transported by mood, but you are transported by details. And so I'm always trying to be more specific in my improv. Other things that maybe we could take from improv for storytellers. This is so funny. I feel like I'm gonna get it wrong, which is such a funny experience I'm having right now.
There's no one that knows it better. There's
yeah,
no
right.
Wrong
yeah, what do we? Yeah, what's this? Yeah. Let's see. Okay. So we want to watch people care. So we want to see. We want to see. Yeah, we want to see vulnerability. We want to see someone who wants to go for something, or even if it's little. I mean, you know, it's like it doesn't have to be some like big dream pursuit. It can be like, God, I want a snack. All I wanted was that goddamn snack. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. but really, really feeling the like, just, you know, yeah, being willing to care. Mm-hmm. Have fun.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Yeah. And then even beyond for storytelling, you mentioned the beginning that like you were taught improv as a value system.
Yeah.
As a way to live life, a philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you bring that into your daily life, you bring that into the stories that you tell on stage. And what are maybe a couple of those values that you'd love to walk around the world seeing more people embracing?
Be changed. Make your partner look good. Accept what's in front of you and play with it.
Amazing.
I'll say that.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's a good spot to end.
Did we
do it?
I think we did it. We did what we did. I think it was great. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me into your home.
Thank you.
I learned a lot.
What a delight.
And to the listeners, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed.
See you next time. All right.
That is it for the first episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You know, improv has been such an amazing gift in my life, so I'm really glad that it was the topic of conversation for my first podcast, and I learned a lot from Lisa. It was really fun. Shout out to Lisa. Thank you so much for agreeing to be my first guest with my show, which currently has zero listeners. And for those who are listening, if you're interested in seeing Lisa perform or learn more about the teaching she does, you can check out her website at lisaroland.com, where she lists everything she's up to. And Lisa also has a podcast called Monster Baby, where she explores the intersection between improvisation and mindfulness. So go check that out. Before we sign off, if you enjoyed what you heard today, please share it with a friend or tell a family member about it at the dinner table. Screenshot your phone right now and post it to your Insta story. Whatever it is, every little bit helps. And please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you want to follow along with future episodes. And lastly, if you can take a minute to rate and review on iTunes, that would be incredible. To be honest, I don't know exactly what it does as far as the iTunes algorithm goes, but supposedly it helps get the message and word out there about the show. I'm really looking forward to taking this journey with you guys, this journey full of learning and discovery about storytelling. And with that, I want to thank you again, and I will see you in the next episode.